With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. For a little bit of context, we just wanted you to know that a lot of these were recorded before quarantine. And as we know, a lot has changed in 2020. So again, please stay safe out there. And enjoy the new episodes of And the Writer Is. This episode is brought to you by the new Quibi series, Royalties. Royalties is a 10-episode scripted comedy about songwriters trying to make hit songs daily. The show is created by and stars Emmy and Golden Globe winning actor, my friend Darren Criss, go blue, who also co-wrote all 10 original songs. Just to give you a sense of the show, they have Mark Hamill as a country star named Philip Combs singing about King Kong's small penis. They have Jennifer Coolidge as a pop diva who decides to do a K-pop collab, and Rufus Wainwright as a dance music icon. You can watch all 10 episodes and music videos on Quibi with a free 14-day trial. And Republic Records has released the entire soundtrack. So go check out Royalties. This podcast is brought to you by CSAC, an industry leader and innovator in music performance licensing. For over 80 years, CSAC has established strong relationships in the creative community by investing in the careers of its top-tier affiliated songwriters and film and TV composers. To learn more about CSAC and its affiliated relationships with songwriters and composers, visit csac.com/origins to learn more. Again, visit csac.com/origins. Today's podcast is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built for musicians by musicians, Bandzoogle makes it easy to build a professional website and EPK for your music. Go to bandzoogle.com to try for free for 30 days and use the promo code ATWI to get 15% off of your first year of any subscription. That's bandzoogle.com and use the promo code ATWI to build your website today. All right. Y'all ready?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
the Swisher gets finished over there.
I don't like Swiffers. Does anyone here like Swiffers?
Like Swift Jets?
Yeah. No, Swiffers.
Swiffer, the cleaner.
Oh, the cleaners. Yeah,
the thing you clean up your apartment
with. It's too much disposable stuff.
Yeah, and they leave these little weird, like hairy particles everywhere. I don't like them. At all.
Harry Particles, the new band.
New punk band.
Exactly. All right, shall we? All right. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame songwriting legends defined a genre simply by being themselves. These heroes are the meaning of alternative music, originals in their craft. These guys sold over 85 million albums worldwide by painting with guitar tones and drawing with emotionally personal lyrics. Still, throughout their success, they've notoriously remained aggressive in their advocacy by humbly fighting for a whole generation. Established in Athens, Georgia, these Grammy Award-winning rock stars formed the year I was born and shaped not just my musical upbringing, but many of yours. 15 albums later, I'm proud to welcome my new friends, and the writer is our Michael Stipe and Mike Mills of REM.
Hello, Ross.
Wow, I feel like we can go now. That was you just encapsulated.
And thank you so much for
that. Was great.
Yeah, exactly.
We love you.
Then the hook comes, pulls us out.
Right. Yeah, right.
The new Price is Right.
Right. Okay, so here's some fun backstory. We're here to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Monster, of sorts, amongst other things. But what's crazy is on the album, you have the live concert from Chicago. I was at that concert.
Whoa.
Luscious Jackson was the opening act.
Incredible.
And I just it was such a mind trip that I think the last time I saw you guys in person was then. So it's kind of fun to see you guys here.
We look great.
You guys
you look great.
Thank you.
How old were you then? 14?
I was 15, yeah.
15, yeah. Wow. So Luscious Jackson must have been quite an opening act for
you. Oh, totally.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing.
Well, you know, that was an interesting band to have as an opening act because I think they had one song that was kind of a hit at the time, mm-hmm. but it must have been something that you guys found that you guys really liked, right?
We only took bands out that we wanted to watch from the side of the stage.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter if they were popular. We took NRBQ out because they're great. We took Pylon out because they're great, and bands that we just like watching them.
Yeah. But that year we had Luscious Jackson, we had Radiohead, we had Blur, we had the Cranberries. Who else, Mike?
Damn.
We had Radiohead a lot.
I can never remember.
Yeah.
We had Wilco on one of those tours. I don't know if that was 89 or 95, but
it's crazy. Well, you know, we'll go back to the beginning before between 1995 when that came out and when you guys started 15 years earlier, a lot of things happened. So let's go to the beginning. Usually I start from where you guys were born, so mm-hmm. we can just kind of do like the briefest synopsis between when you were born to when you guys, you know, meet.
Atlanta, Georgia, January 4th, 1960, Capricorn, Sun, Pisces, Moon, Libra, rising.
Yeah. Fantastic.
That explains it.
And in Vedic astrology, I'm a Sagittarius.
Yeah.
Wow. City of Orange, California, 1958. Moved immediately to Georgia and stayed there until I met the guys that made the band.
So how did you guys end up in Athens? I mean, obviously, a lot of this is Wikipedia-able, but just for the people who are too lazy to look it up, how do you guys end up in Athens?
It's a college town.
Yeah, we were there to go to school, ostensibly.
So how does the band meet each other?
Bill and I were friends from Macon. We'd already been in a band or two together in Macon, Georgia, and we both decided to go to college at the same time to get the heck out of Macon, Georgia, and Bill started dating a girl that had recently been dating Peter, and Michael and Peter had met and were looking for a rhythm section. Bill and I were looking for a guitar player and a front man. We found him.
Yeah, that's about it.
I feel like people who start music now are thinking more often about the commercial part of music and what they can do to become, you know, successful where, you know—
To become a brand.
Yeah, I mean, well, now it's hard to become a band.
Brand.
Oh, to become a brand. Yes,
it's all a brand.
Right. Yeah. It's all about sort of the branding. Even, you know, you grew up you play guitar, and so you have to actually practice a guitar. Now people, their instrument is a computer.
Yeah.
And they're given that. You know, what was the purpose of you guys? You know, you're looking for a rhythm section and looking for, you know, a front man.
Well, why? That was a little tongue in cheek.
No, but on some level, but that's how bands started. You look for if you're a guitarist and if you're a lead singer, you need a guitarist.
You
look for a guitarist. If you need a drummer, you look for a drummer. If you look, you know what I mean? Yeah. Why even start a band in 1980?
Well, Bill and I had been, like I said, we were in bands in Macon and we'd kind of given up on music because all we played was in the 70s, all it was Southern rock. And then my friend Ian Copeland introduced us to all the new music that was coming out of New York and London. So that got us re-energized. And when we came to college, we said, you know, let's get back into this and reform the band. And so Kathleen O'Brien, that Bill started dating, had been dating Peter. She says, well, I know these guys. And we said, well, let's meet those guys. And that's kind of where it went. We played her birthday party and it took off.
That was our first show, was playing her birthday party on April 5th, 1980. But we met, I was 19. I met Peter Buck in a record store that he worked in. He was just really cool. I called him Richard for the first 4 months that we knew each other. He never corrected me. And then I thought he was even cooler and a little odd. But, you know, I had known since I was 15 that I wanted to start a band, and that was going to be my, that was going to be how I was.
Were you writing music at 15?
No. I bought Patti Smith's first album, Horses, the day it came out, and listened to it all night long, stayed up all night listening to it. And that morning I just said, that's what I'm going to do. That's it.
When did you guys start?
I was an early adopter.
What music did you guys actually play on April 5th, 1980? I mean, are these covers or are these originals?
Some covers and some originals.
We had, Bill and I had a few songs from Macon that we brought with us. And that was one of the things that really impressed me, was what Michael and Peter did with the music that we gave them. And I said, well, that's these guys have something that's really cool. So we had a bunch of those songs.
Did any of those end up on?
Oh, Lord, no.
God, I hope
No. Hopefully they're lost.
Could you sing them?
Yeah. I'm not going to.
But could you? Do you have that kind of memory?
Yeah, no.
We had one called Action that I actually played the bass line at a baseball project show not long ago, and Peter was like, oh. I said, do you remember it? He says, I think so. So we kind of played that one for a little bit, and that was one of the early, very early ones.
Did you guys understand, you know, you play a birthday, and the people at the birthday like it? So that's enough hope to go and go back to rehearsal and write new music. What, from that point to, you know, building a fan base, and that was an era where people actually went to shows, you know, for bands that they didn't know, it felt like.
Yeah.
You know, how were you getting the word out? Were you recording demos and people finding the demos, or were you just inviting people to rehearsal spaces? How do you build the brand of REM?
We basically played anywhere and everywhere that someone would have us play. We didn't need a stage. We would just play pizza parlors, gay bars, anywhere that would have us. And eventually, you know, two people in the audience became 10, became 100, became 3,000, became 20,000, became 150,000.
We did some fun promo stuff. We made a 3-song cassette set that may yet see the light of day again. It had Radio Free Europe and Sitting Still and a song called White Tornado that we abbreviated as Tornado. and then, because that wasn't really, you know, getting us anywhere, we said we wanted to find some clubs in other cities, so we cut a 45 just to send to club owners so they'd know kind of what we sounded like, and here's the band that you're going to get. So,
and the 45 took off. People loved it. It's a song called Radio Free Europe. It became the single of the year at the Village Voice. And the B-side was a song called Sitting Still. They both wound up on our first album, but people were watching Athens, Georgia because of the B-52s. It's an incredible band that came out of there in the late 70s who radically, and still haven't really gotten the kind of attention that they should get for what they did. They were so radical, unbelievably radical, and they completely radically changed what was then New Wave, I guess, in New York and LA. People had never seen anything or heard anything like them before.
What is it about Athens, Georgia?
So they were really watching Athens. And anyone that came out of Athens, the band Pylon came out of there, the band The Method Actors, The Side Effects, and then REM. And I don't know, just because of the bees, you know, we got a little bit of an audience everywhere we went.
What about Athens at that time? I mean, there were obviously these pockets in different eras that we can point to.
Yep.
You know, It's a cute town.
Got
a couple of really nice venues. Georgia Theater is there.
Historically, it's a pretty liberal town, college town. It had a rich history of political activism in the 1960s and academic intellectuals and hippies and queers and artists and musicians, and so it's kind of a perfect breeding ground for some nascent scene like this to develop.
And the South is weird, man. I mean, you got to remember, it's a very strange place, and it's a weird place to be different. And so a lot of the people who are the musicians in this particular little scene, you know, and we were, of course, completely unaware that it was a scene, which is what makes a good scene. But, it's a strange place, and it's a strange place to be different, and it's a different place to be strange. So we were all those things, and, just a lot of creative people in a very conservative, in a liberal pocket of a conservative environment, and one of the ways that you act out is to be different and play music and make music your art. There were a lot of these guys were artists that weren't really musicians, but they chose to make their art through music, And that led to something really cool like Pylon. You know, there was only one true musician in that band originally, and the other three were just artists who decided to make noise and turn into one of the best bands.
Who was the true musician?
Curtis Crowe, the drummer, was an actual solid
one of the best
powerhouse drummer, yeah.
Who introduced you guys to the business part? You know, I mean, that you guys are releasing, you know, you have these three songs, two that end up on Murmur, and then, you know, how do you get...
Well,
how do you go from I'm going to record three songs and we're going to tour around and we're building fans? I mean, something switches where somebody says, you know, hey, you guys, someday you're going to be a star. Or try to sell you on something.
Well, this guy from Atlanta, who was about our age, was kind of an A&R guy, and he had seen REM. Mark Williams is his name. He went on to become a very famous A&R guy, but he had seen REM, and He let a few people know on the West Coast at IRS Records that they should fly out to see us at a show. So Jay Boberg showed up in New Orleans. We played in front of seven people that night, and he was one of them.
And the Beat Exchange
introduced himself at the end of the evening. Said, "I'm Jay Boberg," and I said, "I was afraid you were going to say that." And I said, "I'm Michael, and this is our band, and this is what we do." And he signed us.
What a great place. There were syringes in the toilet. It was a kind of a junky hangout. You know, Bill Berry actually used to sort of... Bill Berry was in... he was going to be an entertainment lawyer, I think, originally was his plan. And he was taking some of those classes at school, and he sort of managed the band in the very, very beginning. And then we met Burtis Downs, who became our advisor and took over all that for us.
In the process of being in a place where people are actually singing about things that matter and writing about things that matter, did you feel once there were people saying, "Hey, man, you should sign this record deal. We're gonna release music and all that." Did you ever feel like you should write for a different purpose than for yourselves? Like, did you ever think, "Oh, let's go aim for radio," or were you just doing yourself and then radio just happened?
Yeah.
Radio came to us.
Yeah.
We were steadfast in our desire to put out something that represented who we were, and we were fiercely independent, and we had chutzpah. I mean, we had a chip on our shoulder, and that was our head, and we went into the world like that.
I mean, imagine trying to write for commercial radio in the early 80s. I mean, the only way to do that was you would have to go synth pop like the Brits were doing, but there was no other... I know. There was no way. We were just doing what we felt like doing, and we knew it was good, but we liked it.
Yeah, you listen to Radio Free Europe, and you're like, "Well, that's the sound of 15 years later. It's so ahead of its time for when it was." And when we think about the music that really hits for radio in the mid late 80s or early mid late 80s, it's so much hair metal and so much music that's just so different from you guys, but it doesn't seem like you guys weren't musically capable of going that direction if you guys had chosen, "Oh, let's go chase Def Leppard."
It never occurred to us.
Hair metal made sense to me. If you listen to the Sex Pistols album, Never Mind the Bollocks, it's basically heavy metal with a really, really charismatic frontman and very different lyrics. And then the image that one would expect from that era coming out of London. But it's heavy metal. It's not that far off from Rush or Aerosmith.
Aerosmith, Poison, I mean, it's all pop music dressed up differently, I mean, and just a little bit of different sound on the guitar and a different approach for the singer and a different hair and makeup, and it's they're not all that disparate as you might think they are.
So hair metal coming out of LA kind of made sense as a reaction to punk rock and new wave.
We talk a
That's
lot.
That's not to say I like it.
Sure.
Because I don't.
There were aisles in stores at the time. A lot of what we talk a lot about
there
now.
Actually, there were stores.
There were actual
at the time.
Stores, and people had to define music.
Yeah,
and that's one of the most frustrating things for a musician is when we're just REM.
Yeah.
We're not whatever. We're not pop rock, and we're not wherever you want to put us. You guys always have fit in your own lane. Was it hard for people to, when people started defining you guys, did you guys feel like you had to define yourselves? And, you know, how did that work? Because when you guys are coming out with this music that's reacting at radio,
yeah.
it's when college radio was a thing and regional radio was huge.
Yeah.
So that helped so much in that era. How would you guys...
They didn't know how to define it. Yeah. So they were like, well, it's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not what we are. So it's alternative. So we were one of the first bands to kind of break towards the mainstream and help define what alternative music was supposed to be. Now that's of course an embarrassing turn of phrase now, and it was kind
Wait,
of
Wait, why do you say that?
Alternative?
Yeah.
Because it's not alternative. There's nothing alternative about it. But, I mean, it certainly isn't now. At the time, though, that's what it was called because no one had a name for it, right Mike?
Yep. Well, there was, and there was no need for us to define it because what was happening was there was this whole nascent thing going on in America, primarily, of all these bands who rejected the hype and excess of the current commercial thing. When you think of bands, you think of these, you know, these big, huge, overwrought guys. And there was this whole rejection of that among these people all over the country, you know, in Lawrence, Kansas, and Minneapolis, and all these weird little towns, Omaha. And they were just making the music they wanted to make. And it came about in conjunction with this new format of college radio. And so we didn't need to describe it because everyone knew what it was. It was indie music. It was people making the noise they wanted to make in counterpoint to the prevailing successful music. So we didn't need to label it, and we didn't. That's why we made the single. It's like, well, you know, we don't know what to call it. Just listen to this and you'll know.
And you can't really talk about that era in music without mentioning MTV, because that was such a profoundly important part of what happened then, and the kind of explosion of all these different labels and then different, like, kind of side or micro labels. And where we fit in then, I guess, would have been 120 minutes. So it was the place where they put all the videos that they didn't know what to do with, they would play on a Sunday night.
I mean, how fun, it must have been really, clearly it was fun for you guys because you guys were part, so many of your videos were part of the zeitgeist, and, you know, they would travel beyond MTV. You'd see your videos everywhere. As artists, did you start being inspired to create music that was more fun to film, or did you ever, you know, you start thinking about, oh, this is all one and the same, this is all the same art, while you're writing, are you thinking of, oh, this is how we're going to film this video?
Well, making videos, it was very clear very early on that there was a format that they wanted you to stick to, and we didn't want to have anything to do with that. I refused to lip sync. We didn't want to dance around on stages. We just felt stupid. It just looked so artificial and dumb. So we went kind of the opposite direction. And I came out of art school, so we got really fucking arty. And I refused to lip sync until losing my religion. That was 11 years later, right?
Yeah.
That I lip synced my first ever R.E.M. video. And of course,
it
became international hit single. So I learned my lesson there. But it was because I had seen Sinead O'Connor videos, and I was very emotionally moved by her performances in them. Suddenly, something that everyone knew was incredibly artificial and fake felt to me very real, and I recognized the power of that. Now, Madonna and Michael Jackson had gone the other direction 10 years before that and became who they were through music, through MTV and through music videos. It helped to define the music that they were making. We went the other direction.
Yeah,
thank goodness. Yeah,
it worked. I feel like there's, you know, to me, you had a lot of albums that were working, that were selling, and it feels like Document to me. Maybe I don't know if that's just from me being old enough to understand music at that point, but to me, that's the first album where it kind of gets so, it seems so big. And maybe just because the singles on it started getting so big, you know, The One I Love and It's the End of the World. Those songs aren't number one, they weren't number one songs on the Hot 100, but I think over time, those are legacy number one songs. Did you understand what charts were when you started having these songs reacting at radio across multiple formats, and they're happening worldwide? Are you starting to understand at this point how significant these songs are?
I mean, we chose producers who were going to help us break through some of the doors that were slammed shut in our faces. And
why were the doors slammed shut?
Because we weren't mainstream. But the mainstream was coming to us. That's the beauty of the 1980s is that, you know, it happened again with hip-hop, with rap, which became hip-hop. And now it's happened yet again with post-hip-hop. But you take, you know, Billie Eilish, for instance. You take all the lessons of pop music, you run it through hip-hop, and then you come out the other end, and you wind up with something that's a synthesis of these other styles, mm-hmm. but it's completely different, and it completely, absolutely defines the moment. It's the zeitgeist, and it makes perfect sense. We were that, but the mechanism wasn't in place. People dragged their feet a lot more. They didn't want to come to us, but they were having to because that's where the audience was going.
Yeah. When you would travel internationally...
That's accurate, don't you think?
That's actually... Okay. And the producer thing is true. I mean, we chose producers that we thought did good records and made mm-hmm. good sounds. And the, you know, Life Search Pageant, we worked with Don Gaiman, who had huge hits with John Cougar Mellencamp. And we wanted to get a sound that we felt like represented the kind of music we were making, not so much to get on the radio, which would have been fine, which is what Don Gaiman wanted. He was like, I want to make hits. And we're like, well, you know, if we have hits, that's great, but that's not why we're here. We're just going to make the music we want to make. But if you turn it into a hit, that's fine with us, as long as it sounds like we want it to sound, which it did. So, you know, that was the beginning of that. And then he didn't want to make, the next record because, as he said, you guys don't care about hits. He said, I want to make hits, and I don't think you guys care enough about it, so I'm going to move on, and I got this guy you might like, try Scott Litt. So we did a song with Scott, and we said, holy cow, that works. And that was the next five records. And, you know, Scott took our sound, and his vision was close enough to ours to where, you know, he took our music and made it sound like we wanted it to sound, and that happened to coincide with the fact that, you know, listeners across America were starting to, they'd already rejected the pomp and excess of the previous commercial music, and we're coming over to all this other stuff, of which we were kind of in the front row. So that's how it came together.
Peter Buck once said we were the acceptable face of the unacceptable stuff. I don't think anything true was ever said about R.E.M.
Yeah.
You guys are releasing albums at that time once every year.
Yep. It's a lot of work.
How do you guys stay that? How were you that prolific and still promoting and touring? How were you actually physically writing? And when are you actually writing the songs that you have to then sift through, rehearse, write? All the parts are being written. You know, I mean, how do you physically?
Well,
this isn't
musically. You know, yeah. Instrumentally speaking, you know, when Peter and I were sitting around, we had a guitar in our hands. I mean, you were always playing guitar and
on the bus or in hotels or anywhere.
And mostly in our houses, but yeah, anywhere. I mean, we wrote songs on the road. We wrote songs, you know, in hotels. We wrote them in our houses, you know, wherever you are. We didn't have buses back then. We were in a van, but, you know, wherever you are, you're playing guitar. And you know, when you're in your 20s, there's a lot of stuff in there trying to get out, you know, and it came out through our guitars. And so we had all this, I mean, writing these songs instrumentally was relatively easy because we just had so much inside us. So the hard thing was for Michael, I mean, to write 10 or 11 songs worth of lyrics and not just toss any of them off for a record a year, it was like, I mean, we've got the easy part of this job. So
thank you for acknowledging that.
Hat's always been off to you for that. It's incredibly
therapy. It was a lot of work. But it's all that we had. It was, you know, we were in it. It was really like the Four Musketeers, you know, it was all for one.
It seems like that, and credit wise, you guys have always been really good at giving everyone credit.
Yep.
Where, because most bands break up for not figuring that out at an early point. Who led you in that direction?
Peter Buck. He loves rock and roll more than any human on the planet.
Encyclopedic musicologist.
And he knew all of this. He knew what broke bands up, what helped them stay together, you know, what to do, what not to do. And he said, when we first started, he said, we're going to credit all four songs equally. I said, well, why are we going to do that? He said, because the publishing, that's where you get a lot of the money. And he said, if only one or two of us is getting the money, that's going to break up the band really fast. And I didn't care about the money. I just said, well, shoot, I want the credit. If I wrote the song, I want the credit. He goes, yeah, I understand that. But, and this is the best thing we ever did. You said, in order to have any future with this band, we got to split everything equally. And as it turned out, you know, everybody did a huge amount of work. You know, I might write an entire song, or I might just bring the germ of an idea in, and everybody else would turn it into a finished song. And that's one of the smartest things we ever did.
Yeah, it's just so notorious as the reason why bands break up. And people, you know, bands hate lead singers, and lead singers hate bands for so many reasons that deal with the credit. But even in your videos, you guys always were in the videos together. You guys were always
or not.
But it felt like you guys were always, it was, you know, it always felt like a band.
Well, you know, we weren't one of those like three musicians need a singer. You know, we came as two parts of a package deal, and Bill and I were looking for somebody, and Michael and Peter were looking for somebody, and we, from the very beginning, we formed it as equals. You know, one of the early things we gave each other was veto power. If there's something one person really, really feels strongly against, then we won't do it. And that's just how it has to be in that sort of arrangement for it to last any time at all.
Yeah. Green comes out in 1988, and you guys have, at this point, it's full-blown crossed over as far as it's no longer, you know, this is no longer really, like you were saying, it's not really alternative. At this point, this is mainstream. And it's really it seemed like that those next few years really give permission to the Seattle scene. It gives permission for some people to say, oh yeah, I can go and write music that's not Guns N' Roses and it can still be successful, you know, or, you know, whatever the pop music is of the time. But it felt like that was permission to do music that, you know, it seems
intimate. You can retain authenticity and still be very, very popular. That's what R.E.M. offered. I think that's what we were able to show that.
Did you feel at the time like there were people, did you feel pressure to sort of be leaders in the movement, or is it just it's happening?
There was no movement. Was no movement. We were just doing what we did, and we did it our way and with integrity, and that's what other people saw. We weren't trying to be the vanguard of anything. We were just, you know, we were just doing things the way we wanted to do them. And I think that's what other bands saw, and they said, oh, well, we can be popular without compromising our integrity. Mm. And if anything, that's what we gave to other people.
Yeah, keep in mind, none of these people were famous at that point. They were all starting their own bands, you know.
So right.
That, you know, Eddie Vedder and Courtney Love and Brett Anderson from Suede and, help me here, Jarvis Cocker. And Kurt.
Replacements.
Kurt Cobain all landed on this at the same time. They started their own thing. And yeah, the Replacements actually were one of the bands that we took out on the road very early on.
Did they do things their own way.
Yeah, and the same with Husker Du, and I don't know who else, the Sonic Youth, certainly. But there were a bunch of bands, Black Flag, there were a bunch of bands that were kind of coming up together, Minor Threat, which became Fugazi, or members of which became Fugazi. You know, we were all kind of on the same circuit, and we all knew each other, and we all were pushing for something that was recognition, really. Mm-hmm. And in our case, it became very wide recognition through the songs and through the hits that we had. But it showed all those people that I just mentioned, who were all separate from each other. It wasn't really a scene. It wasn't really, maybe little scenes developed here and there, but it showed that you could remain authentic and do really fucking good.
Yeah.
And get a lot of fans.
The advocacy part.
And pervert MTV. Like you could really, you know, you knew that radio was, we were in a very unique position in that we were able to take MTV and radio and kind of fuck with it a little bit and say, all right, we're going to release this song.
As our single.
Yeah. Because we know that you have to play it, or we know you're going to play it, and people are going to like it because it's so odd and it's such an unexpected non-business kind of move. And then we're going to get the kind of attention that we want for the second single. And that's what happened. It worked.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Banzoogle. From garage bands to Grammy winners, Bandzoogle powers the website for tens of thousands of musicians around the world. Built for musicians by musicians, Bandzoogle has all the features you need for your website already built in. You can sell your music, band merch, do crowdfunding, and monthly fan subscriptions commission-free. You can use the mailing list tools to grow your fan base and send professional newsletters. You also can get live support from their musician-friendly team 7 days a week. Plans start at just $8.29 a month, which includes hosting and your own free custom domain. Go to bandzoogle.com to try for free for 30 days and use the promo code ATWI to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. That's bandzoogle.com and use the promo code ATWI to build your website today. This podcast is brought to you by CSAC, an industry leader and innovator in music performance licensing. For over 80 years, CSAC has established strong relationships in the entire community by investing in the careers of its top-tier affiliated songwriters, film, and TV composers. CSAC uses a selective and partnership approach with its affiliates, maintaining a small base, which enables them to deliver a high level of responsiveness and service. CSAC is also proud of its long history serving music users throughout the country and now represents over 1 million songs across all genres of music, as well as music from hit movies, television shows, and sporting events. CSAC is more than just a PRO and has expanded its business into additional rights categories and markets. They are also building a global licensing platform through a joint venture, Mint Digital Services. To learn more about CSAC and its relationships with affiliated songwriters and composers, visit csac.com/origins. Quibi's new show, Royalties, is basically a satire about And the Writer Is, and it is hysterical. It's basically the untold story of songwriters behind the world's biggest hits and follows the songwriting duo Sarah and Pierce as they navigate the strange and hilarious challenges of creating great songs for insane artists. You can check out the music, which has been released on the one and only Republic Records, on your favorite DSP. So go check out Quibi's new show, Royalties, now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How many times were there songs, or which songs were the ones where you said, this is going to be the single, and they were said, absolutely not?
They never told us no. I mean, when we signed our record deals,
well, not even the label, like MTV and the radio stations, all these people, never ended up happening.
No, it never happened. Not for a long time. I mean, because you know the kids wanted to hear it. You know, they're in there to make money. They're not going to cut off their nose to spite their face just to say, we're not going to play that because you're weird guys and we don't like you. You know, we don't like you guys having the power. We said, you know, here's our song. The fans want to hear it. They're going to call you about it, so you might as well play it.
Well, yeah. I think Losing My Religion was supposed to be the song that was released first that sets up the next song and the one after that. So it wasn't even supposed to be a hit. It was just supposed to be something that got people's attention.
And Drive. We put Drive out, I think, was the first single from Automatic.
That is
not a single. I mean, by any definition, it's really not a commercial single, and yet it was a pretty big hit.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say. Did you guys, at this point, you guys are in your 20s, early 30s.
Yep.
Are you guys being healthy at this point? You know, I feel like the mental health is something that we're talking a lot about as professional musicians in this era. But there's nobody in that era that's talking about mental health for musicians.
Yeah.
Did you have any guidance as far as going from, or are you guys just looking at each other trying to grow up to get?
But you know, it was not an easy time to go through dark periods at all, and to sometimes have them not be recognized or acknowledged even by other members of the band, and we all went through difficult life things, you know. But we had all made it through our 28th year, so that was a good thing. That's a really hard one.
Why? I mean, I know why historically, why the number, but why is that so difficult emotionally? Why is that time of your life so difficult?
It's when you realize that you're no longer young and
you're not immortal. You think you're immortal up till then, and then all of a sudden
you question everything that you are, and it's so important. I think that people approaching the age of 20, late 26, 27, 28, certainly 28. That you know that this is a difficult time to make it through. Yeah. You have to, and that goes across everybody. That goes across all different religions, all different ideas, whether it's astrology or your Saturn return or your 10,000th day, or it's Hindu, it's Buddhist, it's everything. That's a rough time for everyone. You have to kind of chrysalis yet again at the end of your 20s and emerge as an adult. And people sometimes don't make it. So at that point, we had all made it. But the 1980s were difficult for me. I thought I was sick with HIV for a few years, and I couldn't get tested anonymously. So I was really worried about that. I had quit doing drugs altogether at one point in the early 80s. And I quit drinking for a long time. And I quit having sex for a long time. And that sucked. But... you know, I was worried. And then in 1987, around the time of Document, I was able to get anonymously tested the week before we went on a tour to find out that I was not positive and that I was fine and healthy.
Why did you feel that way?
Why did I feel that I was...
Why did you think you were sick?
Well, it was just because it was a pandemic. It was really...
Right,
it was horrible. And if you're queer, you know, it was hitting, of course, the gay population, right. The queer population much harder than anyone else. And so... it was really, really a difficult time. And we had very close friends who died. So, and people who, you know, I had shared beds with, people who were lovers or people who I had shared lovers with. So it was a very, very difficult time. But I made it through and the band helped me. And we all made it through our 28th year. And then what?
I mean,
then we became super famous.
Well, what's weird is, yeah, it really is. That's the real change.
Then we became super duper famous. Yeah.
And we talk a lot about that. What happens in between the years when you look at somebody's discography? It always looks you ask them about the year where the things were commercially successful. Mm-hmm. You don't really ask about the 3 years where there is the development and the. You know, and the head games and whatever else is going on to develop 3 years of your life, and you know, between Green and Out of Time is 3 years of human development and growth.
Was it 3 years, Mike? That seems
Green
like too
came
long.
Out in 88, and Out of Time came out in 91.
Huh? Okay, yeah, because we did the Green World Tour. That took a year.
I mean,
that's
a whole college career.
Yeah,
in itself, when you think of it, so much happens in 3 years of your life.
Yeah.
But for us, that was 3 out of 11 to that point.
So
it was just another part of this journey we were on. I hate that word journey, but that's kind of what it was. And you know, those were that we found ourselves getting more and more popular. And you know, it'd been gradual for us. We were able to deal with it and grow into it and accept it because it had happened slowly over time.
Why do you hate the word journey?
I don't know. It's just too woo-woo. It's life. You know, yes, it's a journey. We're all vessels on the river of life, whatever. But it's just growing. You know, you live your life and you bump into things on the way, and either you fall down or you don't. And
yeah. After you have the cleared, you know, when you get the test anonymously, it comes back, you're healthy.
Yeah. Well, we're still in the Reagan-Bush era.
Right, totally.
So life fucking sucks if you're American, and especially if you're traveling the world. Every time we would show up somewhere, people would be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, did a lot of apologizing.
What's with the cruise missiles? Like, are you fucking kidding?
Sure.
The rest of the world were like, what the fuck are you thinking?
Did you feel like after that two questions. One is, why did it need to be anonymous? And then two, why do you feel like, or after that, did you feel... now that you guys have become famous, did you feel a responsibility to become louder advocates?
Well, this all dovetailed at the same time for me, but the anonymous testing was because there was rumors that they were setting up camps in which to place people who were HIV positive or had AIDS. And at that time, it was a death sentence. People were dying. A lot of people were dying. And so, you know, it was a deeply frightening thing to in that era under Reagan.
And you're in New York at the time, correct?
We were based in Athens, but I was New York has been my second home since the 80s. So yeah,
sure. And then the advocacy for you guys becomes really significant around this time. Now, but like you were saying, it's not just about it wasn't about just the AIDS epidemic. It was about everything. You know,
political, environmental.
Yes. Did you guys think of yourselves as
racism? All the giant problems of America. All the giant problems of America became more abundantly clear under an administration like Reagan and then Bush Sr. And we thought it was the darkest time. I referred to it as the darkest era ever in American politics. I couldn't imagine it could get worse than that. Well, it did, and then it did again. Yeah. And here we find ourselves.
Yeah. Do you find it, and we haven't even gotten a monster yet, and I know we're limited on time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go to Monster, and then I'll ask some broad strokes questions, some Mark Rothko kind of paintbrush okay. strokes. But let's go with Monster. Monster feels like it was the peak of the sort of genre of alternative, where at this point you have. Other bands have their second or third album that's successful, and you guys have become, with respect, the elder statesman of a genre, releasing such a record like that. Being able to release that and then bringing on those bands that you were talking about as your opening acts, the Radioheads and all that stuff. Did you find Monster was at this point a peak of your artistic growth? I mean, it's so different. To me, it's so different from Automatic for the
It's so people. Different.
It's not like any of the other albums previous to it.
That was a clear reaction to our own work. And we knew that to be clear, we had done we had put out Green, we had done the Green World Tour in 1989, and then we took off for two albums. I didn't talk to anyone. I did no press. We did a few TV shows like Unplugged for MTV, but we put out our two most successful records, both really quiet records compared to anything that we'd put out prior to that, and certainly compared to Monster. So Monster was knowing that we wanted to go back on the road, knowing that we had all these now very famous hit songs that everyone wanted to hear that were very quiet or mid-tempo. We needed to write something that was loud and fast and raw and had some swagger. And so we turned to the one thing that we shared as fanboys was a love of glam rock. And this dovetailed perfectly with me shaving my head, proclaiming my sexuality publicly for the first time, and off we went. And it was perfect.
Yeah.
Because the world had changed dramatically in those 5 years since we had last toured, and we were a big part of that change.
Yeah.
So this was our response to, let's say, the Seattle scene, to what was happening in London with Blur and with Suede and with Jarvis Cocker and
Pulp.
Thank you. And here we were doing kind of a little bit of a ironic. It was meta before the word meta was in the line, but this kind of meta ironic distance, able to laugh at our own selves, playing with glam rock and playing with that genre of music and updating it to 1995. It was fucking cool.
Did you guys think of these? I think What's a Frequency, Kenneth, is the first single off of it, correct?
Yeah, it was.
So releasing that as a first single is another one of those, well, this is what we're releasing as our first single, and everyone had to be like, you've now done Losing My Religion, and there's just so many of these classic hits that we haven't even talked about, but then this comes out, and must have been so... such a left turn for radio to be, okay, this is where we're going now.
Also, keep in mind, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, Peter Buck, who was, for all intents and purposes, the leader of the band in terms of what direction we were going, suddenly picked up and left Athens, Georgia, and moved to Seattle and started a family and bought a house And then Kurt and Courtney bought the house next door because they wanted to be next door neighbors to Peter Buck. So suddenly the whole Seattle scene through Nirvana and through Pearl Jam, Eddie Vedder had moved up from San Diego, I think, to front Pearl Jam or to start the band Pearl Jam. And suddenly these people are not only fans, but they're becoming friends and they're doing their own thing and we're pulling from that. But we're already established. We've already done all this stuff. And then we put out these two really quiet records that sold tens of millions of records of copies.
Crazy.
And we now have to respond to how are we as a live act 5 years later. So it all fed into that, you know.
And Peter wasn't going to come back. You know, he'd taken a hiatus from the electric guitar for the most part to on those two records. He played a lot of different stringed instruments, you know, because he was... You know, you just get stultified after a while. So he wasn't going to come back and play the same sort of, again, another word I hate is that jangly stuff, but he wasn't going to play that arpeggiated rock that he'd been playing for 10 years. He was going to come back and play electric guitar in a slightly different style. And so to get that kind of sound, we wanted the loud, aggressive rock, you know, rock, quote unquote, sound. He played guitar in a different way. And by that point, you know, music had changed, popular music had changed, and it had gotten more, you know, guitar oriented, and heavy guitar sounds were not that strange to hear. So when we came out with that song, it was kind of a left turn for us, but it wasn't really a left turn in terms of what was going on in the music world at that point, because Seattle had changed everything so much.
So I know we got like 5 minutes left. So without, you know, you end up with another 8 albums after that or something like that. Something
sounds right.
Like that. Why did you guys decide to call it quits? Why?
To encapsulate the legacy of what we had created and to allow it to not get dragged through the mud by endless farewell tours or greatest hits tours. You know, I'm turning 60 in 2 months. I look great.
I was gonna say this.
Thank you, but I didn't want to be doing that at 60. And some people do it really well. Some people, you know, fucking kudos to Mick Jagger. I think he's awesome, and I'm glad they're out there doing what they do. So this is no diss, but for REM, I think we all realized that we never set out to do anything, but whatever it was that we had wound up doing, we realized, well, this is about as good as it's gonna get, and maybe this is the time to allow it to encapsulate itself and become a complete thing of the past.
Yeah.
And becoming that, it can now move forward. It can now be something that people acknowledge and look at as a complete body of work.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
There were a lot of factors that came into it, but it all played into the final thing of, okay, we've accomplished everything we can possibly want to accomplish. Anything that we might do further, you know, might tarnish the legacy that we've created. Not that we thought about it really as a legacy, but it was this body of work that we'd done. It's like, okay, we're still young. let's go off and be friends and make other music and have other kinds of fun while we still can, instead of beating a dead horse.
I didn't want to become a judge on The Voice or whatever those TV shows are. And I'm sorry, I'm not dissing anyone who does that, but that's not who I am.
Right.
And it's not what I wanted to do in order to place myself in the public's eye as a whatever 51-year-old. It was like, no. That's not.
Maybe there needs to be a show where they have real, you know, there's, I would say they're...
I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, that one.
That's really funny. I was thinking where they have bands that show up that are, you know, that are left of center, that would be something that wouldn't fit in the genre now. Maybe there's some world where we can actually listen to music that it's not about how do we fit this person in the box, and it's more how do we get these people out of the box. I mean, maybe there needs to be some sort of show where we could use your expertise. We'll go to this next segment, which is usually 5 for 5, where I say 5 names and you say what comes off the top of your head. Fuck. But being that we don't have like a ton of time, I'm going to go with at least 2 for 5.
Let's do 5 for 5.
Do 5.
Okay, cool. Yes. All right. Okay, let's go with, I checked over for time. We're good. Let's go with Peter Buck.
Star.
Am I supposed to use one word?
You can use multiple words. I'm not going to get mad at you.
Yeah, one of the smartest people I've ever met.
Yeah. Bill Barry.
Next to Courtney Love, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Peter and Courtney are easily...
Well, let's do Courtney Love next.
Well, you just said Bill Barry.
Oh, okay, Bill
They're
Barry.
Very different people.
Courtney Love and Bill Barry. Yeah. We'll go with Bill Love, Courtney Barry.
Ooh.
Let's go, we'll do Bill Barry first. Let's close out the quad.
He's my oldest friend.
He's the true eccentric of REM.
Really?
Yeah. He's really eccentric.
The least normal one of us.
No Roy, way.
He's
how?
He's the guy that wrote Everybody Hurts. He's a brilliant musician.
Well, he's both very afraid and very fearless at the same time. I mean, to walk away from REM is one of the ballsiest moves you could imagine anyone doing. And he did it.
At the height of our everything.
Who does that? You know, that's and for no reason other than it was just what he felt he should do ready, for himself. Yeah. That's such a brave move. I can't.
Did you guys ever feel like you were going to walk away at any point?
4 million times. Yeah. 4 million times. But we didn't.
Yeah. I mean, we're still here, so obviously. Right. Let's go with Courtney Love. I like that.
Tornado.
Brilliantly talented artist and songwriter.
I think we have to do the other one in this case too, because you've brought him up, and I know that the significance you guys were to him, but Kurt Cobain.
Great sense of humor. Super sweet guy.
Yeah.
Very, very sensitive.
Songwriter.
I have to say, like, my favorite, let's go with Radiohead.
I thought you were going to go to Marlon Brando after that.
Marlon Brando.
Let's go to Marlon.
Yeah, let's go all to right. My favorite Marlon Brando. let's do Radiohead.
Marlon Brando.
Yeah, perfect.
I mean, they are the Marlon Brando of kind of post everything rock. I mean, the word rock to me in 2019 doesn't really exist. It's more a concept from the past. It's an idea from the past. But those guys managed to create their own universe and invite us in, and it's a universe that we all want to be a part of.
Yeah,
I think Radiohead took whatever lessons we had to teach and applied it as well as anyone ever could to their own career and their own music.
Kudos. Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
You know, for all of us, we're for me in particular, I'm so fortunate to have had people lead the way and say it's okay to write music that isn't part of the mainstream. I've been fortunate to have success in the mainstream and then be able to write music that is left of center and make a living off of it.
Yeah.
And it's because people open the door ahead of us. And, you know, the fact that you guys are still here and still making music and doing, you know, you just released, I'm looking at Michael, you just released your solo song in October. You know, you guys are still artists, still creating art, and it gives, you know, it gives all of us hope that if we're just ourselves, that there might be people on the other side of the microphone that want to listen. So,
if you follow your instinct, if you have an idea and you feel really strongly about it, and you follow your instinct, I guarantee you there's an audience of people out there that identify with whatever it is you have to say. I can guarantee that.
Absolutely. Thank
Good
you,
luck.
Guys.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.